I'm Marcus Smith, and this is Constant Wonder. Burial practices vary from culture to culture, as do cemetery designs or configurations. What's normative for you and your culture will seem radical and strange to people elsewhere. I'll never forget observing Memorial Day with my grandmother and her sisters in northeastern rural Utah, the primary business of the day, before congregating with extended family in a local park for a grand picnic. That was always the annual thing. Well, before that, the primary business of the day, I was about to say, was decorating the graves of both loved ones recently departed and pioneer ancestors that none of us had actually ever met. And to do this, we needed to visit three different cemeteries in the region. What struck me as new and initially rather strange, at least for me, was that mowing the lawn at home was an important preparation because we needed the grass clippings in great quantity to take to a rocky cemetery up on a hill where there was little but sagebrush and juniper growing there. The graves on that hill seemed forlorn without any landscaping. And that's where the grass clippings came in. I joined with my relatives as we all dutifully and respectfully began to strew the green mowed clippings in a thick layer over the graves and around the headstones of a few honored deceased pioneer ancestors. Well, that desert hilltop suddenly looked lush and green, and flowers were placed upon the grass then to finish the job. Now, this green was going to be fleeting. Within days, it would turn yellow under the hot summer sun and eventually either molder or blow away. But at least for that holiday, that Memorial Day, we had beautified a place and performed a kind of honor with serviceable greenery. Now, talking about greenery, we are going to talk about green burials a bit now. And it may be that you've heard this concept, green burial. But actually, the story we have in store for you right now is about burials that are greener than green, because we're going to visit a cemetery that takes the notion a bit further. The idea is not just to lay bodies to rest in a way that's eco-friendly. There's that, but there's something beyond that, beyond mere sustainable practices, as you will see. I'm very delighted to have with us now Trevor Crean. Crean has spent over half his life in funeral service activities. He's actually a fourth-generation funeral care provider. He left his family's traditional practice in 2016 and started Heritage Gardens with a new concept that I'm going to say sees cemeteries as a place that might actually be teeming with life. Heritage Gardens is in British Columbia. It's just south of Vancouver in the neighboring city of Surrey. And Trevor Crean is on the line with us. Trevor, welcome to Constant Wonder.
Good morning. Thank you very much.
Now, you have been at this, I understand, for about half a decade now. I said 2016, this Heritage Gardens concept. And I described it as a place that is meant to be teeming with life. Is that an overstatement?
No, that's kind of the destination that we've come to.
But what do you mean by that? How would a cemetery be teeming with life other than the usual decor, the landscaping and such?
Well, we originally set out to, with a background in funeral service, we had worked with a number of communities, and we had seen how over generations, through a lack of access to burial space, traditional burial space, they were getting priced out of the market. So our city and the municipalities around, they set up their cemeteries 50 to 100 years ago, and then that was it. We've done a great job here in Vancouver of getting the world's attention. We had Expo 86, we had the Olympics, and so a lot of people have moved here. And plus, we have a growing population as it is, and yet the local governments were doing a pretty poor job of forecasting what are we going to do as these communities age out to the very end. And so with our firsthand view of this, we thought, okay, well, if we can open up a cemetery space, we'll be able to restore access to that sort of traditional churchyard cemetery for the little faith communities that we serve. And that was our initial objective. In the end, what happens is in our early days, we set up about four or five different community memorial gardens, but these are families that are planning ahead. And so what we didn't anticipate was anybody who, like you mentioned, you have generations of your family already laid to rest in the cemeteries around you. And so we realize that that repeat connection, like families go to where they've gone in the past. And so we had done a good job of offering burial plots to future generations, but we're probably not going to see them again for 7 to 25 years. And so we were out here twiddling our thumbs and realized, well, I mean, we're all from the city. Like, this is a beautiful piece of land. So what can we do to make it as welcoming as possible? And how can we start doing environmental stuff in the meantime?
So did you get on board in that whole mix of considerations? Did you get on board with the eco-friendly burial where there's no embalming? Was that something that you got going on just 5 years ago, or does it go back further than that for you?
It's been nudging in the, you could call it end-of-life care market. We've had a lot of interest over the years, but nothing really organized. And so what happens is when a family is experiencing the loss of a loved one, I would say probably 90% of the time or more, they would be unprepared for it. They haven't had their arrangements in place. The person who is about to pass away or who has passed may not have left any other instructions except for a comment at the dinner table saying, oh, I heard about green burial. That sounds nice. And then 4 years later, they pass away, and that's all that anybody can remember. And so now they're starting to do their homework. And so from the funeral home side, we would do our best to provide arrangements that were as close to green burial as possible. But when you got to the cemeteries all have bylaws that require you're going to need a fiberglass or a cement burial vault. So right away, you can have a simple handmade wooden casket, but it's going into a concrete chamber underground. So there was a conflict. There was a, you'd hit a wall, literally, between what you were trying to practice, live out, and what the cemetery requirements were. And so when we established our cemetery, we removed a lot of the bylaws that would basically prohibit families from having access to natural burials.
So did you have to go to the city then and get the law changed?
No. The bylaws are written by each individual cemetery, at least here in British Columbia. And so the practice of using burial vaults, as far as I've been able to tell, kind of emerged in the early 1900s. And the intent was to make cemetery management a lot easier, because back then, you can imagine, all of the caskets were just simple, rough wooden construction a lot of the time. And you're burying a little air pocket with the deceased. And so over time, depending on soil and your natural conditions, the casket would break down, and then the earth above the plot would slump in. And that's kind of what's led to those leaning over tombstones that you see in older cemeteries. And when you go to Europe and they're all just kind of at 45 degrees, it's because over time nature's doing her job, but she wasn't anticipating us to put monuments everywhere. So that's why you get that kind of configuration. So somebody had the idea, well, let's bury something durable and put the remains inside of that, and then we won't have that maintenance headache down the road. What that inevitably leads to is that each grave is a single serving parking spot, resting place. So that has that's really, I think, what is leading to this whole shortage of space, is that the cemeteries, it's one and done. Or some of the cemeteries offer double depth plots where you can have, for example, both of your parents laid to rest, one at 9 feet deep and then the second parent at 6 feet deep in the future. But it really means that cemeteries are a limited time offer.
So these vaults actually demand more real estate in terms of how many people can be buried on a lot.
Yes. Yeah. And they also mean that, I mean, the teachings tell us it's ashes to ashes and dust to dust. It's not get everybody, let's jump into a concrete box.
Yeah. Okay. So you have reinvented the concept by doing, well, we've discussed, you know, you're getting rid of the vault idea, and you've adjusted the bylaws to accommodate just a pine box in the ground. So you are going to deal with that slumping grave, the depressed concave surface of the top.
Right.
And so do you just address that later?
We are – so because we're a family-owned business and this is our first cemetery, we – started with a much smaller piece of property. So our cemetery is 8.5 acres compared to most metro cemeteries here are about 36 to 100 acres. And so this is what we signed up for, is that, yes, over time, as the graves settle in, we're going to top them up with soil and then replant the grass seed, and we'll straighten out the headstones. So the way legislation works in BC is that 25% of our sales, like our land sales, so any burial or cremation space, 25% of that purchase price goes into a perpetual care and maintenance fund. And so right from day one, we were required to make this contribution, and we've built it into all of our pricing. So basically, at the end of the lifetime of our cemetery, say that we've sold, call it 10,000 burial and cremation spaces, that fund is going to be pretty healthy to just perpetuate the care and maintenance here. And that includes topping up and reseeding the graves and straightening the markers. It'll be a self-propelling machine for until infinity.
So let's say then that we've already taken care of this whole business of it's going to be an eco-friendly burial, pine box, no embalming. Let's start talking about what's happening above ground now, because I understand that this teeming with life business that I'm talking about has to do with what's up in the open air.
Yes. Yeah. So what happened was, once we set up those initial, like a little Orthodox Christian section and we have a little Filipino community section, and once we got our partners in place, that took about a fifth of our full burial lot space. And then things really got quiet out here. And that's when we started to realize that pre-need cemetery, so pre-need in advance of a death occurring, is very challenging to sell. And the two types, the two main types of cemetery ownership here are municipality, which is our city-run cemeteries, and they're not in the business of selling. They're a service to the taxpayer, so they have a very simple offering. It's very pretty, but it's basically operated by the Parks Department. And then you have the corporate cemeteries, which are most of them are publicly traded, and they are pretty aggressive. It's very commercialized. That's also a well-oiled machine, and they pay handsomely to people who bring in pre-need cemetery sales. And so we show up in the middle wanting to do a pretty little eco-friendly thing, and we could not get anyone's attention. We can't afford to compete with their marketing budgets. We can't afford to pay the commissions that they are offering. And that's where we realized, we are up against a tough market here. And so while we were trying to figure out the best way to promote our eco-friendly and family-owned and sustainable mission and values here, we started to look at cremation offerings. So in British Columbia here, we have one of the highest cremation rates in North America. It's over 85% of people that pass away will be cremated here. And from the funeral home side, like back when I was a funeral director, we would work with the families start to finish on funeral arrangements. We would prepare the body, bathe and dress them, place them in a casket. We would meet the family at the church. We'd have the funeral ceremony, and we'd be there at the cemetery when they were laid to rest. But when families came in for a cremation without a service, we would make all of the simple preparations, and we'd file the documents, get them the death certificate, and then the family would come back and receive their urn, and the transaction would be completed. And what we came to the realization just about 18 months ago or so is that a lot of these families, they were kind of rudderless at that point. Unless they belonged to a faith community, they didn't have direction at that time. And so a lot of people would just bring their urn home. And then, at first it's comfortable to have a loved one nearby, but it's amazing how fast 3 months turns into 3 years. And they didn't ever take that final step. There's no pressure on them in a lot of cases, so they never took that final step towards laying their loved one to rest. And so we started to receive calls from families just inquiring, like, hi, I heard you're eco-friendly. Like, I've had the remains of my mom and dad at my home for a while, and I really think it's time that I should do something for them, but I haven't seen anything that I've wanted yet. Like, do you think we could come out there and arrange a little garden plaque and maybe plant a tree? And we're like, well, yeah, that sounds awesome. Let's help you do that. And that is rapidly becoming our focus out here. Like, we are starting to tap into a lot of people who have either unresolved grief, or they haven't found closure yet. And we're attracting them in a cool way, because we had beehives already, but everything that we do here, we invite families to participate. And this is what I think was lacking, is that cemeteries have been very transaction-based. They say, oh, you have a deceased person on your hand, we have a place for them, give us your $10,000 or whatever, and we'll take them off your hands. And then there's no consideration for the ceremony, and they leave that up to the funeral home, the funeral director, or the pastor, if they're a member of a community. But in the instance of cremation, the family, that the funeral home is gone. They often don't have a pastor. That's why they're at home with the ashes in the first place. But our background being in funerals and ceremonies, that's what we're offering people now, is we're building ceremony with them and giving them that sense of peace and closure in an eco-friendly way. And it's become pretty cool.
You know, you just tossed off the word beehives as though that were all in a day's work there. But we're getting closer. We're getting closer to this life above ground that I'm talking about, because as a place to visit, a cemetery could just be the landscaping where somebody mows the lawn, or you can start talking about beehives and other sorts of things going on there. And that's what we're going to talk about after a short break here on the show. We're visiting with Trevor Crean, and he is with Heritage Gardens in Surrey, British Columbia. We're going to talk more about this green concept of his after this break on Constant Wonder. Stay with us. Thanks for listening to Constant Wonder. I'm Marcus Smith. Our guest right now, Trevor Crean. He's the general manager of Heritage Gardens in British Columbia, in Surrey. That's just a city outside of Vancouver. And Trevor, we were talking about all of this aspect of what an eco-friendly burial might be, how somebody might then keep the cremains long and then decide, well, I really want to have them interred someplace, and you've come into the picture there. But then you just tossed off this word beehives. Generally, one doesn't go to a cemetery and expect to see beehives, but that's just the beginning of what you're doing in terms of fostering life above the ground. I want you to talk to us about what you're doing with vegetables and pollinators and those beehives.
So in our early days, we had an open house shortly after we opened, and we had about 3 dozen people from around the area and a couple of our friends come out, and we had a little questionnaire out on the table asking, every other cemetery you go to in town is kind of manicured like a golf course. Here, we want to focus on environmental friendly initiatives, and so do you want to see us trim the place up like a golf course, or do you want to see us incorporate nature as best as we can? 100% of people said, work with nature, not against it. So what we realized is, I don't know about the focus where you are, but up here we're bombarded all of the time about the how pesticides and chemicals and agriculture is wiping out our pollinating insects. And so we thought, okay, first thing we can start with is let's get some beehives out here. And when you mow a lawn, you are leaving just the short grass. You're taking off all the weed tops. It's dandelions that the insects use for pollinating. It's clover that they're looking for. And so when you mow the lawn, you've just got an ocean of empty, useless nutrition for pollinators, so they got to go elsewhere. So what we've done is the unused areas of our cemetery, we mow around them, like near the roadside, so it looks organized. But then the center in the spring and summer, we let the middle of the field just grow wild. We hit it with bags of wildflower seeds, and they just pop out with all sorts of colors, and they're very handy for the pollinating insects. And that in turn brings birds, and that in turn brings other animals. So we end up here, it's kind of like the opening scene of Bambi for a good 3 months a year. And then we sustainability is, it takes more forms than just being eco-friendly. And so we really believe that if we're going to be, if we're going to base our operation on sustainability, we have to do more than the eco-friendly. And for us, that means that we had to keep our place affordable so that it was accessible to families. And the other thing is that we had to look at how can we give back to the community. And so we already knew our office right now on the site is a farmhouse that was built by the previous owner, and so that's what we've been using for offices. But there's not any space here to have a gathering or celebration service, and so we know that we'll need a building one day, and so we've earmarked a beautiful half acre for that development, except it's probably not in the works for 3 to 5 years. And so I was speaking with my uncle, who is a farmer from Eastern Canada, and he moved out here a few years ago for a nicer climate. And I said, "Hey, Stan, how would you feel about being the caretaker at the cemetery?" And he said, "Oh man, that would be awesome. I get to live in that house." I said, "Yeah, there's one condition. We're gonna need a farm." And so he's out there on that building site where it's right now it's just a nice open lawn, and he began to start growing veggies. And in the early days, we would just give them to friends, like visitors and families that we had served. And it's a pleasant surprise. It's definitely unexpected. But what we're thinking is, like, we need to build connection with people, and we wanted to provide a setting that people would feel comfortable returning to. Like, we wanted to be a lot more than just that sad day of the funeral. We want them to want to come back and say, "Oh my gosh, look at the beehives. There's more of them this year." Or, "Hey, maybe we're going to see a deer this time out at the cemetery." Or, "Hey, if I come in June, I might leave with a bag of tomatoes and some zucchinis." So it makes us approachable. It makes it relatable. And that is a huge part of finding peace in laying a loved one to rest.
Well, don't you think this is more than just the window dressing of helping people along with their feelings? You're actually merging farmland with a burial plot.
Yes, in a sense we are.
This is not like a new concept. If you go back to ancient cemeteries in, say, Europe and places, you're going to find some places where there are, you know, orchards near a cemetery. And the idea that it's proximate to the grave, maybe not right on top of a grave, but that's pretty close.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah, that is something that my sister was doing research on this, and she says, "Hey, wait a minute, there's actually some really cool stuff people could do." I'm not ready to start planting apple trees above people, but when folks come out and they see the lay of the land, they get it really quickly. It's the online crowd that is just like, "What, food in a cemetery? Like, no thanks." And it's, you know, the people who are going to take the time to actually speak with us and come and visit, they're like, "Oh my gosh, this is cool."
So you're out and about from on the plot. You're not stuck in an office, are you? You get out there.
Yes, I get out there. My brother became our heavy equipment operator, which is too bad because I was really hoping in my visions of grandeur that we would sell out in the first couple of months and I would just get to mow the lawn and be Forrest Gump out here for the rest of my days. But it's been a lot harder to get the attention of the Metro and to distinguish ourselves from the other cemeteries, because that's a big part of getting people to choose us. They have to see why we're different. So that's what I've been doing with my colleague Andrew. He's our marketing director. And so my little bro got to come in here and take all this brand new heavy equipment, and he's out there learning it and stuff, so he's really good. But yeah, from time to time I get to mow the lawn or work with my brother on projects and just get outside and enjoy the fresh air.
Are you seeing anything that's measurable in terms of increased diversity of life there? You mentioned deer. You've talked about the bees. That's kind of artificial to bring in a beehive. But, I mean, that works for me. But are you actually able to see measurable increase in the bounty of the place, of living things in the area?
Well, that's a tricky one because, they are wild animals still, so they specialize in going undetected. But we have a wildlife corridor. So on the southeast corner of our property is the Little Campbell River. It's a very important salmon spawning habitat for about 4 different salmon species. So in our rezoning, our property used to span the river, and in our rezoning, we allocated about 3.5 acres to the permanent conservation of that corridor. And it's basically a highway for deer, coyotes. There's beavers down there. We restored a bunch of the plantings because there was invasive species and stuff, so we hauled out about 4,000 nasty plants, and we put in all of these native plants along the water course, and then they got completely eaten alive. We see where we see where those trees went in the first place. But there's life out here, and our beehives are now tripled, actually. We began offering families the ability to sponsor a beehive in memory of a loved one, because in a lot of cases, families go out to like their cabin, or they'll go out to a mountain nearby or down to the beach, and they scatter ashes in a little family gathering there. But what they're losing, it's nice in the moment, but what they don't have then going forward is a focal point for visiting their loved one. It's really hard to take your kids down to the beach and say, oh, yeah, so think of Grandpa. He's somewhere between the beach and that island over there. And so we offer a focal point. And with our beehives, for example, this year we have 6 out on the property that around our grounds, we have a little bronze memorial bee or a memorial plaque butterfly. And those are just in memory of people who have they've touched our lives and moved on, and now their family is going to share the proceeds of those beehives with their friends and family members with a little label that says Grandpa Jack's Bees from Heritage Gardens.
Who's Grandpa Jack?
Grandpa was my grandfather. We personalized the label for whoever the loved one is to that family. We make up individual labels, and each family would receive a supply of honey to share with their friends and family. But Grandpa Jack was kind of... He passed away in 2013, and he was one of the reasons that we got this going is because even though I'd been in funeral service for most of my life, when I was the one making the decisions about his final resting place, I realized, oh my gosh, like this is really tough, and I didn't like any of my options. And so speaking with my parents, we said, well, let's start some new options.
Yeah. So how much of this is marketing strategy? How much of this do you really believe in, that you're really into the idea of as green as you can get at a cemetery with productive land that is farmed for food, that has pollinators, that brings in wildlife? There's a lot of competing aims here, and I'm wondering, it would sound like a little Shangri-La, but I know, you know, farming is work too. I'm wondering if this is for real.
I'm trying to make it as so, yes, farming is work, but rent is also, that would be, there's income that I've traded off there. I try to make it as neutral as possible. So Stan, my uncle, gets a free place to live. In exchange, he runs the farm. I get, it also helps working with family because you can exhaust them and you don't feel bad about it. So my brother works 6 days a week when he has to, and I give him a pat on the back and say I love him. And so it's, you know, like in terms of a calling in life, my great-grandfather set out over 100 years ago to serve families at one of the hardest times of their lives. And through the generations, I've known the other two generations of my forefathers that have really ingrained in us that as far as the human journey goes, we're all going to be judged at the end. And so I want to be able to shrug and say I did the best I can. So I'm, you know what, this is putting food on our table. I'm not going to drive a Ferrari one day, and I don't want to.
Yeah, but as far as the environmental aspect here, do you see that your enterprise is going to make a substantial dent in the way either people think about sustainability, the way they think about eco-friendly burial, the way they think about the cycles of life and the cycles of death as well? Are you philosophically on board with this?
Absolutely. And I, you know, there's only so much that we can do. I know that I won't change everyone's mind. And, you know, not everybody's mind needs changing. Like I think that the faith communities are the best example of, they have a process for the milestones in life. They know how to celebrate birth. They know how to celebrate weddings, and they know how to honor a death in their community. And that kind of structure provides the spiritual guidance that a lot of people need. But if people don't have faith in their life, then they are rudderless at some of these important times. And so what we're offering them is we give them a bit of a sense of direction. We bring them a sense of comfort. And if we can do it in an eco-friendly and sustainable way that aligns with their values or the values of their loved one, then that's closure. And that's what people need.
Do you know of other places, either in your country or down here in ours, others that are doing something similar to heritage gardens that are trying to have either beehives or pollinators or farming with vegetable plots? Do you know of anybody else doing this?
The food thing is pretty off the wall. I can't think of anyone off the top of my head that is doing that, but I know that beehives is a cool one. Like, there's some eco-friendly cemeteries popping up off of our coast. We have the Gulf Islands and Vancouver Island. There's some cool eco-friendly cemeteries out there that are more just serving their local residents. And they even the city of Surrey here in where I am, they're looking at getting beehives, which, you know, little finger wag, guys. But in the end, it's better for the environment. Okay, go get your beehives at your cemetery. But I hope that it catches on. You know, if you consider that cemeteries, who is laid to rest in a cemetery that says, I hope everybody comes here really sad and miserable, and they don't want to enjoy their time here, and they don't think of it as a good use of space. I think most people who have gone before us, they're the generations that built the cities we live in. They built the bridges. They built these roads. And I think that they would consider it a sign of respect if we were to embrace the grounds where they're laid to rest and make them as valuable and meaningful as possible.
Trevor Green, it's just great to learn about what you're doing. And thank you so much for spending time with us to describe it for us. It's a pleasure to visit with you.
I really appreciate your interest. Thank you so much.
Trevor Green with us. He's the general manager of Heritage Gardens, the cemetery that we've been talking about. It's in Surrey, the city of Surrey, just south of Vancouver, Canada. Speaking of various cultural traditions for handling our graves, handling the dead, when we return to Constant Wonder, we're going to learn about furta sacra, a very old practice that medieval monks had of stealing bones from neighboring monasteries. Very curious history there. We'll be back to tell you all about it. I'm Marcus Smith, and this is Constant Wonder. We can learn a lot about various societies and how they handle their dead. You know, hundreds of years from now, it's quite likely that archaeologists will be exploring our cemeteries that seem so modern to us. They're going to be puzzled by our rituals. What strange cult would lead us to build concrete vaults under the ground or to preserve bodies with chemicals? We're just not that different from the ancient Egyptians now, are we? And how far removed are we from the relic obsession of the Middle Ages? In medieval Europe, it turns out, monks would travel to different monasteries, break into the tombs of saints to commit holy theft, furta sacra, it's called. And these relics were then brought back to their communities, and the thieves were praised for bringing miracles back home. To learn more, I spoke with Patrick Geary, who's an emeritus professor of medieval history at the Institute for Advanced Study in Princeton, New Jersey.
From the early Christian period, the marks of the martyrdom in particular, those who died as martyrs, their graves were venerated, and because their bodies would be raised integrally, then there's the desire for other Christians to be buried close to them so that when that saint rose, others would rise up with them. It was sort of tagging along with the saint on the last day. So this idea of being buried near saints became very important. It also became increasingly important that the central Christian liturgy, the Eucharist, should be performed in places that were sacred. And these places were sanctified by the presence of these martyrs. Early Christian cult services often took place outside of the city, around the tombs of these martyrs. By late antiquity, some church councils required that there had to be saints' bodies in altars where the Eucharistic celebration took place. So there is a demand for these bodies. And first it's where the body is, then the bodies begin to be moved as powerful figures will go to outside of the city and bring the bodies into their cathedrals or into their churches. Then they begin moving around the Mediterranean with powerful imperial officers being sent to collect bodies, particularly for Constantinople, as Constantine and his successors want to sanctify their city. So bodies begin to move around. But what happens if you have a church that doesn't have a saint? How do you get a saint? How can you have these things? Well, I think there are three ways you get them. If you don't have one, you might be given one by someone. The Pope is passing out relics to people. He's passing out saints' bodies. People go to Rome and they request them. Bishops will divide up relics and pass them on to the churches under their control as a kind of patronage network. You can even trace the relationship of superiority, inferiority by who is distributing these relics to their churches. So that's one way to get them. But of course, that puts you in a relationship of dependency because you owe it to the person who gave it to you. The other possibility, as you suggest, is purchase. And there are people we know from at least the 800s, who are professional relic merchants. How they get the bodies, whether they're actually getting bodies from particularly Roman catacombs, one can ask. But they travel around to important monasteries and churches. They show up on feast days, and they offer their wares for sale. That's fine, but you really want to be sure it's a real relic. You want to be sure that it's a powerful saint. And can you really trust somebody who's selling these things? What Chaucer's pardoner is selling, Chaucer calls them piggy's bones, and probably a lot of them were piggy's bones. So you want to be sure these are real relics. But if they're real relics, why would the original location give them up? Surely, if this is a powerful, miracle-working saint, the local community is not going to allow somebody to take parts of them and sell them monasteries north of the Alps. So the third possibility is you steal them. You go to a church. It may be a church that's been abandoned. Maybe it's been destroyed by barbarians. Maybe there have been civil wars in the area. The church is abandoned. The saint's relics are there, but he's not receiving the veneration that he deserves. And you go into the church, you take it, or maybe he is receiving the veneration, but you think that your church could do better by him. So you go, you insinuate yourself into the community, you may join the community. According to some of these stories, you may wait a long time, some cases they say years, until you're left alone with the saint. Now, of course, the saint is a powerful figure. If he doesn't want to leave, or she doesn't want to leave, there's no way you're going to move that saint. So they're notorious for just refusing to move. But if you're successful in picking up those relics, getting out of the church, escaping the community, well, the saint clearly must have wanted you to do it. So you're actually participating with him in his search for a better church where he will be more properly venerated. So these are the arguments. And of course, if you've done that, then you are not beholden to someone who gave them to you. So you don't have that relationship of dependency. And you haven't bought them from someone, so you don't have this question about whether this person is a fraud, because your trusted monk or cleric has gone to that place, has seen how the saint was venerated present, and has brought it back to your community. Does that make sense?
Well, there are two questions that kind of emerge out of everything you've said. The first thought I have is the idea that it seems like churches or cathedrals at some point almost become houses, not so much of worship, but houses for the saints themselves, at least in some sense, to a place for those saints to have their new life, even if they are just bones. And
absolutely.
The other thing that kind of strikes me is that there's almost a misnomer to call it furto or theft at all if this is a noble and venerable enterprise to procure the bones. There's no shame in it because you've redefined the entire thing as having the blessing of that saint.
You're absolutely right. Churches belong to the saint. When people make donations to a monastery, they're not making the donation primarily to the abbot or the monks. They're donating it to the saint and the abbot and the monks who venerate him there. So churches, monastic churches in particular, are very much proprietary churches in a certain spiritual sense of the saint. And this is a fundamental characteristic of pre-modern Christian practice. So the saint is the important person. Now, of course, there may be many saints in the church. There's one who is the patron, but there may be many, many other collections of relics in the church. But the church very much belongs to a saint. There are these relics of that saint, hopefully, but also of other saints. And that builds up the more you have, the more power there is present, more spiritual power of these people who are both physically present in your church. And at the same time, as saints, they are already enjoying eternal bliss with God. So they are a connection, a strong connection from earth to heaven.
To me, I come equipped with the idea that these are artifacts, that they're physical remains, but they are more like museum pieces. They're kind of inert. And if I had come equipped with the theology that was shared in the Middle Ages by the believers, I think you're telling me that my view of these would not be that they are artifacts. They are the actual saint, the actual presence of that being. Maybe not resurrected, but the saint is there.
Absolutely. The saint. This is a saint who is present in his physical remains. These are not just dead bones because of the faith in the resurrection, which is at the end time, but is already a reality for those who are saints. So these are not just objects. These are objects of great power. And there are stories, of course, of cures, and people make pilgrimages to these saints. They make vows. They make offerings. This is a fundamental Christian impulse that people will vow to a saint to undertake a special activity, usually a pilgrimage, to pray to the saint for intercession. Christianity is strongly, traditional Christianity is strongly intercessory. You don't go right to Donald Trump and ask him for something. You go to your local representative or maybe your ward boss. You go up through the chain of command. Well, you don't simply go to God and make a demand. You go to someone who is right in your community, the big man in the community who is a saint. And so the saint is rewarding people who are devoted to him or to her. But the saint can also be dangerous. If you approach those bones without proper reverence, you may be struck dead. You may be struck blind. These are very, very powerful objects that must be approached properly, treated properly, cared for properly, or very bad things can happen.
So to have these bones, to have these relics in the church, you have tangible, concrete objects that to the believers represent immense power, but also I would imagine just the presence of that those powerful bones in your church, that affords some sanction or credibility or authority to the institution of the local church as well.
It absolutely does. Frankly, it also brings in a lot of money. If you have an important saint, an important shrine, then pilgrims will come to the church. They make donations of in kind or in money, objects, material goods that they bring in fulfillment of vows. And this becomes a considerable income. And this is sometimes even quantified in legal suits, for example. A dispute in the city of Noyon in France, in which both the cathedral and the monastery claim to have the body of Saint Eloi Eligius, who was an early bishop of Noyon. When the bishop forbade people to make a pilgrimage to the monastery to Eloi because he said the body is in the cathedral, the monks actually sued the bishop in ecclesiastical court for loss of revenue. So it's material, it's spiritual, it's a source of prestige, but it's also how these institutions attract the faithful, and with the faithful, the donations that make their institution survive. So it's not purely a gross materialist attempt to deceive people for money, but money, wealth, prestige, protection are all part of this. Likewise, having a powerful saint can be a deterrent to those who might harm the church because of fear that the saint, as the protector of that church, will wreak revenge if someone pillages the church, steals from it, misappropriates its property, and so forth. So the saint is the patron. He's the protector. He is the one who is to protect the community. Therefore, you want a good patron who is appropriate, valuable, and known. And one way to acquire this is to go to a place where a saint has not been properly venerated and to remove him to your church.
Yeah, you're kind of performing a bit of an act of redemption in a way.
Well, these will be the arguments. When the tomb of Saint Benedict, the founder of Western monasticism, has apparently been abandoned in Monte Cassino after raids and violence, then some monks from Gaul, from a little place, Fleury-sur-Loire, go there, and they presumably take the body of, they find it abandoned, he's not being properly cared for, this is terrible. They take the relics back, and they establish them in Fleury, the monastery of Saint Benedict on the Loire, Saint-Benoît-sur-Loire. And this becomes a major source of their identity. This is the community of Saint Benedict. He works miracles there. He attracts pilgrims. This is an extremely important presence of the founder of Western monasticism, no longer in Italy, but now right in Gaul. Of course, because of the advantages of remembering how one acquired a saint as a theft, it's quite possible, and we have cases in which the story of how a saint got to a place changes over time. And sometimes, oh, someone brought it to us, we found it, and then later on, we stole it. So actually, the story of we stole the saint becomes, over time, a respectable way of remembering how a famous saint ended up in an obscure location. It doesn't mean that this happened, and perhaps part of the reason that one is not usually prosecuted for this is that the community that already had the saint says he's still here, nobody stole him. But we have to remember that in this pre-modern Europe, there is no church with a big C. There are many, many churches with networks of communication, but tremendous autonomy. And the sense of belonging to this larger community is not as strong as the sense of the very local devotion and identity with one's local community.
So you would actually have competing churches where they'd be vying for prestige between themselves.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. You have competing churches vying for prestige. You have churches that are both claiming the same saint, or a number of churches that would claim the same saint. You have claims that are not recognized, of course, by the other churches and may not even be aware. A church in Italy may not have any idea that some church in France claims that it has the body of one of its saints. And with the particular case that you started out, these Roman martyrs, they're from already the 8th century, as the German world, the Germanic world, is being Christianized. There are no saints there. You need saints. You need to get saints from someplace, and you want genuine saints. It's your saints that I believe, I'm not certain about this in Vienna, I think these are probably rather late additions. But from the 8th century, there is a movement of missionaries going to Rome, being given relics by the Pope, and then going to these areas to implant them. So you have to have relics, you bring them, and the best relics are Roman relics, because this ties churches to Rome. It shows that they are part of the Roman system. And so there is an interest from the 8th century right up to the 19th century of distributing Roman relics. And the best saints are always martyrs. So the Roman martyrs are ideal.
You were on the money when you mentioned the Vienna church, because from what I've read, those were additions from the early to mid 1700s under Cardinal von Kolonitz. And so we're talking about relics that came much later than the medieval period.
This is part of the Catholic Reformation movement of reestablishing practice in the following the turmoil of the Protestant Reformation, and bringing these saint remains into Vienna, but many places. Los Angeles, California Cathedral was dedicated to Saint Vivanus, or Vivanus. Who is this? Nobody knows anything about this person. Los Angeles, of course, has an old Spanish tradition going back to its founding period. But in the 19th century, following the First Vatican Council, with a desire to tie Roman Catholicism in Los Angeles, not to its Hispanic background, which was being marginalized by Anglo settlers. The Irish and Italian hierarchy wanted to kind of forget about that whole Spanish tradition that was to them suspect. So they went and got a martyr from Rome. Nobody knows anything about her, but there's a tomb that had her name on it, so she must be a martyr. So these relics are brought to Los Angeles. They're set up in the new cathedral, which is built not in a Spanish mission style in continuity with California, but a 19th century Catholic Restoration style. And this becomes the patron saint of the Los Angeles Cathedral. That cathedral has recently been replaced by quite an extraordinary building. But this is a long-term thing. This has been going on for almost two millennia.
Patrick Geary is an emeritus professor of medieval history at the Institute for Advanced Study in Princeton, New Jersey. Tomorrow here on the show, we're going to hear the story of one of the most famous pirates in history. We're also going to hear the story of one of the first persons to lead and survive a circumnavigation of the globe. And we're going to hear the story of one of England's greatest naval heroes. Actually, all three stories about the very same man. Same guy. The Improbable Life of Sir Francis Drake. That's tomorrow here on Constant Wonder. I'm Marcus Smith. Constant Wonder is a production of BYU Radio.